Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Syria, where street battles are underway in Damascus, indicating the fall of the Assad regime might happen sooner than expected. Rafif Shujati joins us from Cairo. She is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian local coordinating committees inside Syria, and we will discuss claims that the Assad regime has already used chemical weapons against the opposition and look into whether Syria's WMD arsenals might end up with Iran or Hezbollah. Then we'll examine a report by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations released Monday about the extent to which the global British bank HSBC has been engaged in laundering money for Mexican drug cartels, dealt with Iran, Syria, and Cuba, and is doing business with a Saudi bank that was an early benefactor of Al-Qaeda. Former banking investigator William K. Black, the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, joins us. Then finally, we'll speak with Thomas Ferguson, who has been investigating the deletion of key files at the Federal Election Commission, documenting so-called dark money contributions from some of Romney's biggest donors, such as the Swift boater Harold Simmons. Tom Ferguson has an article at Alternet revealed key files on big-ticket political donations vanish at Federal Election Commission. Joining us now from Cairo, Egypt, is Rafif Shujati, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordinating Committee inside of Syria. Rafif helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the world public about events inside Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Shujati.
Thank you.
So what are you doing in Cairo, Egypt, Rafif? Is there support for the Syrian opposition? I imagine there is, right?
Well, specifically, I am in Cairo helping to put on a workshop for nonviolent tactics in the Syrian opposition. And as we've spent time in Cairo, we've noticed overwhelming support from just about every person we've talked to.
At this point in Syria, it does seem, with battles going on in Damascus itself, roadblocks being set up by the Syrian opposition between the city and the airport, many people are starting to see this as the beginning of the end, if you will, for the Assad regime. The Iraqi government has called upon its citizens to leave Syria. How close do you think this is? I mean, obviously, the Assad family still have enormous military assets at their disposal, and the opposition is divided and lightly armed.
Well, so I don't know how close the regime is to full collapse, but what we do know is that if the fight is now in central Damascus, and it is, we know that the regime is going to have to divert its forces from other cities and towns to, in a sense, defend Damascus. So we know that it will most likely heat up in Damascus if the fighting is taking place at the heart of the city. It can't be much longer for the Assad regime. We also have the significant high-level defections of ambassadors now. And, of course, Manaf Plus, the brigadier general, who also happens to be a childhood friend of Bashar Assad. So these new developments are extremely significant. And I think we feel optimistic that the collapse of the regime is being expedited.
Well, apparently, according to Israeli military sources, the Syrian army on the Golan Heights is being withdrawn and redeployed, presumably to Damascus. Apparently, when Vladimir Putin was recently in Jerusalem, he was asked to lean on Assad to secure the chemical weapons arsenal that the Assad's control. And also the Syrian diplomat, Nawaf Faris, who defected from Iraq, he has gone public saying that he thinks that the President Bashar al-Assad would not shy away from using chemical weapons on his own people. He also charged that the Assads had colluded with al-Qaeda in carrying out attacks on American soldiers and personnel in Iraq during the Iraq War. So let's start with the chemical weapons scenario. What's your understanding of the size of that arsenal, and what does the Syrian opposition feel about the possibility of being used against them, or conversely, capturing it?
So the activists have been saying for a couple of months now that there is evidence of chemical weapons use in the different towns and villages that have come under military assault. We've had situations in Zabadani, in the Damascus suburbs, and we've had situations in Homs where people have been treated for skin rashes and other ailments most closely associated with different types of chemical warfare. We do know that Syria has stockpiled one of the greatest quantities of chemical weapons. And just earlier today, I was reading reports that in a couple of different cities, helicopter gunships were actually releasing a red substance and dropping it on the residents. So we think that the Assad regime is in fact using some type of chemical weapon against civilians. Moreover, I don't think we should put it past the Assad regime to use chemical weapons. They have violated every other standard of decency or of human behavior, so there's no reason to think they would shy away from further destruction.
So,
in terms of the forces moving from the Golan Heights, that is correct, and goes to prove that Assad, who has long been the champion of resistance to Israel, is really focusing his military might against his civilian population.
So tell me about, again, I'm speaking with Rafif Shujati, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees in Syria, where she helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. In terms of your work with Egyptian activists, what is the understanding in Egypt and, by extension, Syria? My understanding is that a lot of the belief systems of the opposition in both Syria and in Egypt are based upon conspiracy theories, if you will. In Egypt, a lot of the secularists and the left who brought about the revolution, who've essentially lost out to the Muslim Brotherhood, believe that somehow the United States wanted the Muslim Brotherhood in power, which seems far-fetched. And then on the other hand, in Syria, I was just talking to the Amnesty International monitor who snuck into Syria and witnessed massacres there and documented them for Amnesty International. She said that lots of people inside Syria say that somehow the Bush administration and the Americans deliberately took down the Iraq regime because they want to empower the Iranians and the Hezbollah and the Assad Alawite regime. Is that true, that these are common belief systems?
I don't think so. I don't subscribe to conspiracy theories like that, and I certainly can't speak to what the Bush administration intended to do in Iraq. I believe many of the Egyptian activists feel that their revolution was stolen from them by political parties with other agendas. Now, in Syria, certainly there are competing political agendas, and the country is rapidly descending into chaos. I believe that chaos has been perpetrated by the Assad regime because it knew very well that there would be groups willing to capitalize on the chaos. The regime is sowing sectarian strife. It has allowed its borders to be very, very porous and allow in different types of groups. What I can tell you is that the Syrian activists are standing for democracy and freedom and dignity. They're looking to organize themselves in local councils. They're looking to implement democratic processes as much as they can. Now, as the conflict gets increasingly militarized, and as the international community continues to meet and discuss the Syrian situation, there's no doubt that other nations' regional and strategic interests are coming into play. But I do not believe that the United States has an interest in propping up the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, and I do not believe that the majority of the Syrian population would ever want the Muslim Brotherhood to be the reigning government.
So what do you think then there are two realities here, I guess, Rafif Shujati, what's happening on the ground? And, you know, the Red Cross have just come out and said that it's a civil war, which could invoke humanitarian actions and lawsuits and criminal prosecution later. In fact, the British foreign minister, speaking at a refugee camp in Jordan today, warned the Syrian regime that they might face the International Criminal Court But what's your sense then of the two realities, what's happening on the ground, particularly with battles now in Damascus, and what's not happening at the UN? Because they've apparently postponed the meeting that was supposed to take place at the Security Council to push Russia and China away from their support of Assad.
I think there's a huge discrepancy between what is happening on the ground and what the international community is doing or how it's reacting to the tragedy that is now Syria. On the one hand, in Syria, of course, there's an armed conflict in that the FSA is shoring up its strength and taking on the Assad regime. In response, the Assad regime is using helicopter gunships and missiles and mortars and very sophisticated weaponry that's provided by the Russians. So this is on the one hand. On the other hand, the international community has launched multiple condemnations and urgent communiques asking Bashar Assad to stop the killing. Of course, he has not responded, nor does he actually care. I mean, he doesn't even consider these appeals. The international community postponing a UN Security Council decision is simply postponing this conflict. And what they're failing to understand is the extent of the humanitarian disaster that is taking place in Syria. We have now close to 2 million internally displaced people. We have more than 16,000 dead. We have more than 200,000 people who are in prison and being tortured. So the international community needs to quit postponing and take some significant action. If we can invoke Chapter 7 and place specific sanctions against the Assad regime, that would be an extremely positive step.
Well, in my conversations recently with the Amnesty International official who went into Syria risking her life to document massacres in 23 villages following the Syrian army, she spoke to people who had been imprisoned in jail cells that were 4 by 5 meters that contained 120 prisoners jammed in, and that they would take them out routinely and torture them. And many didn't come back. They simply died under torture. And those that came back from torture said that they would rather die than go back and be tortured. So this is the MO of this regime. They've been doing this from day one. So I don't understand why the international community doesn't, why they stick to the figure of 16,000 dead. If you've got 50,000 missing and at least 100,000 in prison, and if they routinely torture and kill people in prison, wouldn't the death toll be at least up to 100,000 by now?
Well, the death toll conceivably could have surpassed 100,000. We only report what we've been able to verify and document. And you have to understand that the verification and documentation process in itself is an extremely dangerous mission, because anybody caught doing that verification is arrested and then tortured and presumably dies under torture. In fact, we have lost a great many activists simply because they were documenting or filming or verifying information. So in reality, we will probably never know the true death toll of this Syrian revolution. What we can do is communicate as much as we can, as often as we can.
Again, I'm speaking with Rafif Joujadeh, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees in Syria. And we're talking about the latest fighting that's going on inside of the capital, Damascus itself, and the extent to which the Assad regime, according to a lot of people, including Secretary of State Clinton, are in their last throes. But there's a great deal of concern, obviously, about what happens to the arsenals, particularly Syria's vast chemical arsenal, which is rumored to be one of the biggest in the world. And they also have biological weapons as well, apparently. You've told us that already the chemical arsenal of the Assads is being used against the Syrian opposition. And that is in itself so appalling, it's hard to get your head around. But what about the possibility, as some people have expressed concern, that both Iran and Hezbollah, who are allies with the Assad regime, may end up inheriting these arsenals?
Oh, I think that's a fear and should be taken seriously. Again, we come to the international community to see what it is prepared to do to, A, stop the civilian casualties, B, address the humanitarian situation, and perhaps most importantly, make sure that that arsenal of chemical weapons does not fall into the wrong hands.
So do you think that Russia can, I mean, I mentioned earlier, Rafif, that Shimon Peres, the Israeli president, when he was in discussion with Putin recently, urged Putin to urge the Assads to secure the chemical arsenals. I'm not sure that Assad's even listening to Putin anymore, is he? And one of the unfortunate things about Putin, from my Russian sources, tell me that he honestly believes that the opposition in Russia against him is being fermented and being organized and paid for by the CIA. And he is in many ways sympathetic to Assad's similarly ludicrous notion that the Syrian opposition are paid agents of foreign powers. I mean, it just boggles the mind, the idea that you could pay people to stand up in the middle of the street and face snipers and tanks. I just can't believe that you could actually pay people to risk their lives like the Syrian opposition is doing.
Well, certainly failed dictators are always going to jump on the conspiracy theory and discuss paid armed gangs from the West who are there to spread chaos. This is an old story and really comes right out of the dictator's manual. So it's an old story. We're all familiar with it. So no, I don't believe people are being paid to, as you said, face snipers, have their towns and villages blown up. We have entire villages that have been eradicated in Syria. Nobody's being paid to do that. Whether or not Putin can pressure Assad would really depend on whether or not Assad is in any sort of rational frame of mind. And as he once said, any government that fires on its own people is led by a crazy person. So we have an admission of insanity. We see completely irrational behavior. We see, in fact, suicidal behavior. We see a regime that is prepared to stop at absolutely nothing to crush a popular revolution that has grown steadily day by day and month after month.
So the figures on the number of defections of Syrian soldiers from the Syrian army are up to 13,000 have defected to the Free Syrian Army, and that includes 60 to 70 senior officers. Is that your understanding?
Oh, I think the number is actually higher than that.
So this is a good percentage.
We have estimates of some 40,000 soldiers who have defected publicly. We have estimates of several thousand other soldiers who, in fact, have defected but have not announced their defections, and, in fact, they're helping the opposition. There are still tens of thousands of soldiers who have been restricted to their barracks because of the fear of defection. So in essence, the operating forces of the Assad regime are gradually diminishing.
So, Rafif, since you're in Cairo, Egypt, what's your sense of this big, important Arab country weighing in? It's sort of been on the sidelines. I mean, the Saudis and the Qataris have been leading the opposition and funding it, as much as I know, and to some extent Turkey has been cooperating. The U.S. seems to be staying out of it. Israel seems to be staying out of it. What's the likelihood of the new Egyptian government weighing in on this catastrophe in Syria?
From what I can tell during my brief time in Cairo, Egypt has its own problems that it needs to address, and I think they will probably stay busy with their own affairs. They should stay busy with their own affairs for the time being. And I think any pressure they exert should be through the form of the Arab League, which seems to be more or less united in the call for Assad to step down.
Well, just in closing, Rafif Shujati, do you think it will take then for if the United Nations is paralyzed and if China and Russia for their own reasons don't want to exert their influence, and we may well be exaggerating how much influence they have over this delusional family that's been in control of Syria for so long and simply believes that that's their destiny and can't accept the idea that their own people want them out. What's your sense of what it will take? Is there anything that American citizens can do, people that may be listening to this program?
Oh, U.S. citizens certainly can pressure their own representatives to, in turn, pressure the administration to take more action. Certainly they can donate to the various relief efforts underway to alleviate some of the human suffering that's taking place. But I think now that the conflict has reached Damascus, it looks like with increasing defections, both military and diplomatic, it sounds like the Assad regime is going to collapse very, very soon. We understand that the economic sanctions that are in place are beginning to take good effect. And so it's quite possible that we won't need the international community to step in to remove Bashar al-Assad. It looks like the Syrian people will be able to do it themselves. What we will need is post-Assad support as we rebuild the country. As you know, the regime has shelled huge amounts of land. They have set fire to agricultural land. They have annihilated some villages, and most of the major cities are in various stages of complete destruction. So we're going to need to rebuild the country from the ground up, and I think that is where perhaps the international community can be effective in helping us to rebuild civil society and infrastructure.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today from Cairo, Egypt.
Thank you.
Rafif Shujaati. Again, I've been speaking with Rafif Shujaati, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees inside Syria. She helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take actions and to inform the world public about events in Syria. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Senate investigation into the British bank HSBC. I'm getting my money the fastest. Memos and facts and shredded up documents. Slush funds through the corrupt continents. But they don't want me indicted, cause they don't want my dirty laundry aired when I fight it. Don't get my lawyers excited, cause what good is a law if you can't rewrite it? I got CIA traitors, dictators, so whistleblowers and haters. I got your country in my pocket. Got in the ocean coasting with the sails out. Hey America, thanks for the bailouts. I made off at the Banco Ambrosiano. Got away scot-free like El Vaticano. Activists, get mad at me. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And the Senate released a report on Monday, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, and on the extent to which the global British bank HSBC has been engaged in laundering money for the Mexican drug cartels, dealing with Iran, Syria, and Cuba, circumventing U.S. sanctions, and doing business with a Saudi bank that was an early benefactor of al-Qaeda. You know, what's left, Bill? I mean, stealing candy from kids? I mean, what worse things could these people be up to?
Stick around. Yeah, you know, our mantra continues to be, if you don't look, you don't find. And what this discloses is the agencies have been controlled by people who are anti-regulators. And so they have not found, and we've had to rely on the Senate. This is Senator Levin's committee, which, as with Washington Mutual, provided the real disclosures. It's an absolute demonstration of how badly the regulators have fallen.
And this, and specifically, are the regulators at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Apparently, they have been asleep at the switch since 2001 up until 2010. And there's a new guy, a new sheriff in town, Thomas Curry. He's taken over in April. He testified to the Senate today saying he'd do a better job. What do you think of him?
Well, it'd be hard to do a worse job. So that's certainly possible. Curry is at least a professional regulator, which is the first in a very long time for the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which I've shortened OCC, regulates the largest banks in the United States, the national banks. But it did not used to regulate HSBC. That was done by the Fed, and the Fed had found violations of, wait for it, money laundering at HSBC when it was cracking down there. And so HSBC changed regulators, which is something you can still do too often, to try to get weaker regulation, and it succeeded at the OCC. The OCC has certainly not shown anything yet, but Curry is new because the Republicans stalled the ability to appoint anyone to as a successor to Dugin, who was a someone probably no one has heard of, but it was a complete disaster.
So a lot of the top executives of HSBC apologized to the Senate hearing today with Carl Levin in charge and Tom Coburn on the Republican side. Apparently, the real testimony that people are waiting for is from Stuart Levy, who joined the HSBC Bank in January as chief legal officer. He's due to testify, and he had been the Treasury Department's top official on terrorism finance from 2004 to 2011, during the time when he's supposed to be involved in the cracking down of HSBC for its Iran-related money laundering or circumvention of sanctions. What do you know about him?
Well, what we know about him is that this is what happens all too often with regulators. The job offer you're most likely to get is from the place that is the sleaziest, because they want to use your name and reputation as, well, you know, back off. We can't be doing anything wrong. We have one of your top people. So to go through this organization, one of them announced his resignation, but only from his position, not from employment, at the hearing, departing from his prepared text. He was chosen because the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency had said that the head, his bigger boss, was incompetent to conduct these activities. So the incompetent guy hired this incompetent guy who's just stepped down but kept his salary. So he doesn't have to do the work, but he keeps getting paid. The another guy that testified is the guy that allowed the Mexican drug operations to occur and said, well, you know, yeah, I learned all kinds of terrible things about what we were doing. Some of it made my hair stand on end. But there was just too many frauds for me to crack down successfully. So they promoted him. And now he's in charge of Asia and such. So you can imagine what's happening there. If you took everything at the nicest possible way to HSBC, then they've just proved what everyone has been saying for a very long time. These institutions are too big to regulate, they're too big to sanction, they're too big to fail, but most of all, they're too big to manage. They would be vastly more efficient, and they would have at least a chance at honesty if they were shrunk massively. And HSBC is a trillion-dollar institution, to give you an idea of scale.
Again, I'm speaking with William K. Black, who's a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He investigated the savings and loans disaster of the 1980s and put a lot of people in jail. He's the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and the author of the bestseller, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. So the fine that they're expected to pay from the Justice Department investigation, that's chump change. I mean, the most recent fine, apparently whatever they're going to charge is going to be a record dwarfing the $619 million that the Dutch bank ING agreed to pay in June to settle similar accusations.
Yeah, all of these settlements are for chump change. They sound large, but compared again to the scale of the institution, nobody thinks that they're going to change the behavior for the good. By the way, the one that was also announced just last week, and that was Wells Fargo, with the the largest dollar amount, right, forever in a discrimination lawsuit. Well, that isn't even real money. That one just says they'll make, X hundreds of millions of dollars of loans. Well, they would have made X hundreds of millions of dollars of loans anyway. So this is a game. Once they agree to settle, they structure the numbers so that they sound large.
Well, but I guess it's one thing to settle for ripping off people or not complying with your obligations to clients and et cetera, or charging people too much, or all of the sort of routine chiseling that goes on. But it's another thing.
Fargo was seeking out Latinos and blacks to discriminate against. That's what they settled.
Right. Well, yeah. I'm not downplaying it, but I'm saying that you would think that these revelations involving HSBC that say that they laundered billions of dollars for drug cartels and for terrorists and for states that the United States have sanctioned, like Syria and Iran and Cuba, you would think that all those red-blooded patriots would be up in arms about this.
Yeah, and it's barely a blip in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I checked just before going on. And indeed, it's not even structured that way. It's structured about the guy announcing his semi-resignation. That's the news, as opposed to the massive violation. So if this was a small, in the mall type entity that moved money, right? And it did one bazillionth of this, it would be out of business. There would be federal marshals. There would be, literally 30 FBI agents coming in and such. It would be shut down, and the people would be indicted. And they would be actually tried, and they would actually be convicted, and they would be sentenced to meaningful terms.
Well, what about that?
That would be if they sent $15,000 to Saudi Arabia illegally.
Right, but I mean, let's just talk about Saudi Arabia then. The HSBC executives apparently have been doing business with the Al Rajhi Bank in Saudi Arabia, even after they were told that its owners had links to organizations financing terrorism. And the bank's founder was an early financial benefactor of al-Qaeda. I would have thought that would have gotten somebody's attention.
Well, you know what happened at the hearing today with regard to that? That official testified, and he apologized for his intemperate language that he used with his subordinates to force them to do this illegal transaction.
Say that again. I'm dumbfounded.
He apologized for being harsh in his communications with his subordinates, in which he forced them to do this deal over their objections. It's so British, it's wonderful. They don't apologize for sending the money to the terrorists. It's for being rude to subordinates. A real sin.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I'm too busy to watch television during the day. This sounds like it's better than soap opera, this stuff. I mean, this is the testimony today before the Levin's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations.
Yes.
And then we're looking forward to, I guess, the testimony coming from the guy that, the Dracula in charge of the blood bank guy, the guy that they just hired that used to be in charge at the Treasury Department of following dirty money. And HSBC, the global British bank, have hired him, presumably so that they can not be caught the next time, right?
Well, so that people would think that nothing bad could happen there.
I see. I see. Well,
oh, and you know everybody that you're dealing with, so you field the phone calls and you ask them about their wife or their husband and, you know, their kids, baseball team, and you all get lovey-dovey and such. And the hope is that will reduce the regulators coming after you. And it's clear they would have absolutely gotten away with this but for Senator Levin. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency was going to let them get away with this.
Again, I'm speaking with William K. Black, who's a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He investigated the savings and loans disaster of the 1980s and put a lot of people in jail. He's the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and the author of the bestseller, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. So what happened to the old 363 formula that used to govern banking? In other words, you get the money from the Fed at 3%, you loan it out to your customers at 6%, and you're on the golf course by 3 p.m.
Well, these days you own the golf course, so you can go on the golf course anytime you want.
And you get the money from the Fed at nothing, and you lend it out to customers at, what, 20% or 18.5% or whatever?
No, you don't loan it out to customers. You sit on the money.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, in terms of credit cards, yeah.
Yeah, essentially you buy bonds of Brazil and places like that. And then you talk about how much smarter you are than everyone and how much harder you work than everyone and how much how superior you are because you're willing to take risk compared to the other folks and complain if they complain about how much money you make.
And if some seedy-looking guy in a white linen suit carrying a large suitcase stuffed with $100 bills comes in, you eagerly take his money. Or if he's Saudi banker associated or one of the early funders of Al-Qaeda or, you know, clearly an agent of Iran or one of the countries on the so-called, U.S. hit list, the evil, what was it called, the Axis of Evil?
Axis of Evil.
Right. I mean, we get into conniptions about what a criminal state North Korea is and how they counterfeit U.S. currency and have all kinds of rackets. We know why they do it, because they're dead broke. But the idea that the United States tolerates and the banking world is doing far worse, and somehow or other they end up with a slap on the wrist in front of a Senate committee, and they get to have a little mea culpa. And I don't know, are any of these guys going to jail? I don't think so.
Well, they could, but that would require prosecution, of course, and the Justice Department doesn't do that much anymore with regard to the big banks, and it hasn't all this decade. Decade isn't young, but for 10 years, roughly, since the Enron-era prosecutions, they've largely given it up, except in the insider trading realm. So to fit in with this, the most incredible answer in the history of regulation occurred, and that was they asked the Federal Reserve, why didn't you do more when you learned that LIBOR was this huge violation and cartel? And the answer they got back from the chief legal officer for the Fed was, or the New York Fed was, it wasn't a safety and soundness concern, so we don't have jurisdiction. So felonies are no longer a safety and soundness concern.
So it's okay then for the banking cartels to rip off municipalities, cities, and steal from the, and by the way, a lot of them are going broke. Not surprisingly, if they're being ripped off by these bankers who are in collusion with traders to get huge fees at the expense of municipalities trying to issue bonds, which they're discounting.
Oh yeah, which they also rigged the bids.
That's what I mean. They rigged the bids so that they get the cities get less money.
They rigged LIBOR, but they also rigged the bids to actually do the bond selling. So they get you every inch of the way. Yes, I mean, you've just shown that HSBC is the hub of the axis of evil, right? It's what everyone went through to provide money and take money to make the corrupt people even richer and more dangerous. And if anybody else did this but elite bankers, they'd be in prison, they would be picked up, as I say, they would be hounded into the bowels of the earth by their neighbors as the scum of the earth and such. And you can see none of these things happen. These are all people that go home after these scandals and are invited, you know, stay in all the clubs. I mean, have you even heard of somebody being kicked? You grew up in England. Has anyone even been kicked out of a club?
No, I didn't grow up in England, and I certainly wasn't invited to join a club. But I'm descended from convicts from Australia.
Oh, that's right, Australia. Sorry.
But I must say that convicts don't behave in this way, not like bankers. I thank you for joining us, William K. Black.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s and put a lot of bankers in jail. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. He's the author of the bestseller, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the Federal Elections Commission apparently have destroyed an enormous number of files on some of the biggest donors out there. Clones on phones, snipped out drones, never made they wrong. I know to make they wealth, they'll break they self. All paper, stand for paper, music capers, love they haters, desire to jealous, body lovers, crying fronters, lies and cover-ups, self-promoters, slippery slopers, speculate, hella hate, be full steady eye in your plate. That you want me to do, yes you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, and a contributing editor to The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and has an article at Alternet revealed key files on big-ticket political donations vanish at Federal Elections Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there, Ian.
And just as yesterday in the Senate, the Disclose Act failed. Not that that was a surprise, but of course it would have been an attempt. It was an early attempt after Citizens United was passed to close these massive loopholes, allowing tons of money to pour into the electoral system. It was shut down back then, and then the Senate tried again, I think probably for purposes of political posturing, but the Republicans are resolute, and they shot it down. Now, you have revealed and uncovered that the Federal Elections Commission, who have oversight over the donations that go into political campaigns, have deliberately destroyed files. Is that, am I hearing that correctly?
Well, deliberately, who knows? They're certainly deleted from their files. Now, I need to begin. There's a few updates. It's been an exciting day. The first thing I should note is, you know, I didn't do the piece by myself. My colleague Paul Jorgensen at the SAFRA Center at Harvard, and Ji Chen, the university statistician at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, with me, co-authored it. And the other thing is, of course, we had to put out a second piece to today, because the FAC seemed like wasn't quite clear. It's a funny way stuff surfaces. Reporters in the middle of the morning somehow suddenly said, well, you know, you can find the stuff that we said wasn't there very easily. Now, I will tell you that you couldn't find it very easily a few days ago. But I finally, with my colleagues, put out a plain statement that said, look, you know, we're not going to stand for people telling us that everything is fine with this system. We have the earlier data downloads, the bulk downloads that the FEC uses. That's the thing that becomes the real record of electoral contributions. That's the stuff that the Center for Responsive Politics and other organizations use as the basis for their presentations of data. We said, we've got the original downloads, the January download that had all these contributions in it. They are missing from the July downloads. And we started to put them up. We said blankly that we are going to post them all, and anybody can check for themselves. Now, late this evening, the FEC issued a statement claiming, well, yes, in fact, through a technical glitch, those downloads were, in fact, bad. But they know. These are the people who didn't know, I presume, until today, that they had a serious problem with their downloads are nevertheless confident that the information was really always in their system. You know, all I can say is it's a wonderful coincidence that the glitch has just happened to hit the politically sensitive items like the so-called 501c4s, that is to say the charities and public interest organizations that were precisely the object of yesterday's vote in the Senate, that is to say to actually make them disclose. We're talking about here so-called dark money. I'm not going to beat up the FEC any more than that, but the data downloads were wrong, and they've now conceded it. That was the claim in our article. We said if you went onto their site, there was at least one way that you could find them, which is in their original records that they were filed, and we said this plain as day. We were right, and they are conceding it.
My understanding is that they have not made this thing user friendly at all. That most regular people can't even access these files, and that the Center for Responsible Politics have to dedicate a lot of people and effort to deciphering these files. Right? Is that?
Yes. That I regret to say that has been true for many years. Now you might well ask, why aren't your tax dollars used to put, if they're going to publish this stuff, why can't you easily access it? Why not just put it in an Excel file that people can use? Now, there is a problem when you do the sort of big data sets. Excel's too small, but it just won't take a data set that big. But, you know, you can use SPSS, which, while I understand for most of your users, Excel's the only thing they know. Lots of people know SPSS. If you've gone through a university course in economics or some of the social sciences, you probably had some introduction to it. This is a serious problem. I'm not a big fan of this development, and it was precisely, you know, my colleagues and I suspicion that there might be misinterpretations, because real data is messy. We didn't begin by thinking there was a problem with the FCC. We started figuring, look, we know that real data is messy, so there may be some questions of interpretation, particularly because of the complex structure of these files. And, you know, we've found a lot of new things, and we've used modern database management technology, I think, for the first time. We got a lot of stuff that nobody else has, including millions of dollars in new contributions that turn out to be in there. But we also came across these deletions. And the other thing one can mention in this context is if you call the FEC, which we did ring them up earlier in the week, and started in by asking a question on to explain their interpretation of their rulings on whether or not charities had to disclose, because it's a pretty peculiar history, we were immediately told by their press person they can't talk, you should call a non-profit. You know, they actually told us to go to the Center for Responsive Politics. Well, I've known people there for ages, so I did call them, but I mean, you know, it's time to, you know, for the FEC to talk on the record to the press, besides the commissioners. I've heard, I can't vouch for this myself, that they are, the press people are actually under instructions. The only people who can talk on the record are the commissioners, so they can clarify that. But the whole, we've known for ages the FEC is paralyzed as a regulator. It's clear now, I think, that we've some problems with the mere recording of the data. Those need to be cleaned up.
So Thomas Ferguson, again, the professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. And he's the author, along with Paul Jorgensen and Ji Chen, of Revealed: Key Files on Big Ticket Political Donations Vanish at Federal Elections Commission at Alternet. Now, the commissioners are totally polarized, right? They're in a standoff. Mitch McConnell put a Republican in there whose job was to absolutely eviscerate the FEC.
Well, yeah, he removed, he helped, he's usually credited with designing a piece of legislation that forced the general counsel, Larry Noble, to quit. And there's not much doubt that McConnell has a big interest in how the Republicans on that commission behave. They'll have to talk for themselves. But yeah, they certainly have a lot of 3-3 votes. You know, I mean, absolutely no question. They're polarized. You know, my take is, and it's past time. Campaign finance reformers are rightfully concerned with the Supreme Court. But, you know, if you put the FEC into a normal civil service operation, instead of being, as it is, uniquely under the thumb of congressional leadership, I think you could do a great deal right there to sort of improve disclosure. It's become ridiculous.
Well, but the Congress, you know, they've been fighting along with the banking lobby to kill off Dodd-Frank because it does work. These commissions don't work. The Commodities Futures and Trading Commission is another example.
Well, careful. I mean, that's a mixed case. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission didn't work well a few years ago.
Right.
It did, however, begin the investigation that led to LIBORs. And I think Gensler's done a fairly good job there, though they've got some problems in explaining to do on the Peregrine bankruptcy and the MF Global there. But
they sat on their hands while billions of dollars were stolen from the American consumer at the gas pump.
Absolutely. No, but that's not Gensler.
Not Gensler, I understand, but I'm saying that's the kind of mechanism that the Republicans prefer. They want to have a commission as opposed to something with real teeth, that they can stack it so that it gets paralyzed. And that's clearly the case with the FEC, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Well, I think you could set it up like the National Labor Relations Board. That's maybe not a wonderful example because that is not paralyzed, but it is. Republicans have tried to paralyze it. Let's say the Federal Reserve Board, which another not perfect regulatory vehicle, but there's not much doubt they don't just do what congressmen and women want. And I do think that you can structure these organizations. In general, as you perhaps remember, we've talked about this before, I think the whole structure of regulation in the United States needs deep reforms, and they've got to get the capture by the affected interests out. But you know, I think our institutional knowledge suggests that you could do better jobs and that you're not stuck forever with a completely corrupt show. Though I would add that you have to have a much more active press. I was close enough to some of the Dodd-Frank stuff to be... I could see the way that congressional behavior would change as the press would actually begin to get near what they are doing. There's no substitute for an active press there, and that's, of course, another problem.
Well, just going back to the deletions by the FEC and this mysterious disappearance of some of the most critical files, particularly those pertaining to dark money, my understanding is from your investigations that, for example, people like Harold Simmons, who's one of the biggest super PAC donors to Mitt Romney, his contributions, and he, of course, is famous for the Swift Boat campaign against Kerry, and for the financing television ads linking Obama to the Weather Underground guy. And you've got
John. That contribution that went missing, and that's specifically that one, that was a little under $3 million in 2008.
And that's just disappeared from the records.
And
John Templeton.
Not in the download, and the FEC is effectively conceding that now.
And you've got. And you've got John Templeton, and also this guy Foster Freeze, who gave a lot of money to.
John Templeton Jr. Yeah.
And their contributions have disappeared too.
They were out of there. Yep. They absolutely.
So my understanding is, and we've only got a couple of minutes left. My understanding is there's no scrutiny now on the 501c4s that are being used, and we don't know whether corporate America is using these because they don't obviously want to give money publicly because they'll offend half of their customers. So,
well, what happened was this: in 2007, the FEC decided that people contributing to those type of organizations did not need to disclose unless the money that they gave was specifically virtually earmarked. It's become known as the earmark test, though the word's not used in the original ruling, was earmarked for a specific ad. You know, that's crazy. I mean, what happens is everybody then just says, we're giving the money for the general purposes of the organization, and, you know, then it pours out the ads. That's what they did. It's a crazy ruling, and I would note that that was a crazy ruling not from the Supreme Court. That was the FEC. I mean, you could change that ruling tomorrow.
Well, that we'll have to wait till after the election to see whether that's possible. Yeah. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Ian.
And we'll stay in touch on this one. There's obviously more coming.
I think, however, this particular episode is over. We were correct in claiming that the stuff was not in the bulk download.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor at The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and he has an article at AltaNet revealed key files on big ticket political donations vanish at Federal Election Commission. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.